Hi, everyone, and welcome to the live fundraising success webinar, The Devil is in the Details, How to Avoid the Pitfalls That Could Derail Your Event, sponsored by Eventbrite. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success and the host of today's webinar. Fundraising events can seem like a great idea. Everybody does them, but pulling them off can be tricky, and one seemingly little oversight can mean disaster the day of, and even the most perfectly planned event can be a bust if it's not properly promoted. That's what we're here to talk about today. This webinar will help you draw up an important checklist for planning, promoting, implementing, and even following up your special event. But before I introduce our speakers and kick off the webinar, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Also, please turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets at the bottom of the console. And don't forget, your console is interactive. Click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. Okay, with that out of the way, here today to discuss fundraising events, we have Gail Perry, President of Gail Perry Associates, Catherine Yando, Senior Director of Major Gifts at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Laura Huddle, Senior Category Manager of Eventbrite. Gail, let's start with you.
All right, Margaret, how are you doing? And thank you so much for inviting me. Everybody who's attending, I just want to warn you that Catherine and I are both in North Carolina, and we are Southern, so you'll probably hear a little bit of this accent. But I like to think that Southerners are social people and that we really enjoy having a great party. And I would like to challenge you today as we look at the details. We will be drilling down into the details, but we want to challenge you to see if you can turn your fundraising event into the best party in town. So I'm going to be challenging you to see if you can ramp up the energy of your event to turn it into something wonderful. And here's a picture of myself and Catherine, and these are not our regular old formal business pictures. These are pictures from a party. And actually, I took Catherine's picture at my Christmas party, and we were having a lot of fun. Just so you know who we are, there's a picture there. And so I just want to tell you that I did put together a little toolkit on my website with my favorite top party tips, fundraising event tips, and you can reach it at fireduppfundraising.com/handout/events. So you can find that there if you'd like to download that. And so now, here's why we think you should be able to turn your fundraising event into the best party in town. And by the way, this is a real party that I did attend. I did not take the picture, but wouldn't it be wonderful? Just think how much money you could raise if your guests were this happy and this joyful and this connected. The reason I think a lot about this line of thought is that what do you think the difference is between an event and a party? Well, in an event, it's not really about the food. It's not about the fancy food. You know, it's more about the fun that people are having. And this is a picture. The lady, the happy lady who's holding up her bidding paddle, is a guest at one of the North Carolina Museum of Art famous auctions parties that they have there. And Catherine, in just a second, is going to tell us a lot about the Museum of Art's secrets to getting everybody in the state there paying the biggest ticket prices that take your breath away, that nobody in the state has ever paid. Catherine, I don't think anybody in the state has ever paid as much for an event as the ones that y'all have had at the Museum of Art. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think we were the leaders in really setting the ticket prices at pretty significant, starting, I think, among the first to do over $500 for tickets.
I remember when I was much younger, 20 years ago, I managed to cough up $500 because it was such an important event that I wouldn't dare miss it for the world. And because it is that the Museum of Art has a certain formula that we'll be talking a lot about today to make it so special. So let's talk about what are the benefits of having the best party in town. You know, I think that if you can have the best party in town, you rope in a whole lot more people to your cause. You know, I think you can raise a whole lot more money. You can enhance your reputation. And so let me just share with you my tips and Catherine's tips to create an event, both planning ahead and all the details and then at the event so that you can maximize the most money you can possibly raise. And so one of the things that I think is really important is to have a certain attitude about your party. Catherine, how did y'all decide to have the party of the decade in North Carolina when you had your 20th anniversary gala?
That gala was one that set the tone for all museum events going forward. And I think what it was is that we felt everyone should come to the art museum. Everyone should come and have what you're talking about, Gail, the very best party in town. And so we wanted it to be high profile, high energy, and as Gail is saying, fun.
Mm-hmm. And so I think you start with your mindset and you sort of name it and claim it if this is what you want to have. And then, you know, another thing to think about way ahead of time when you're setting the stage for the event is your branding. You know, what are you going to call your event? And some people get married to a brand, you know, like this is a funny picture about I promise to cherish Winterfest. And, you know, people get locked into a certain brand. But I do think that historically a fundraising event has a life cycle, and that some brands can get tired. If you're using the same event format and the same name of your event maybe 10 years, you're going to start to see a sagging of interest. So we think you should keep your brand and your theme fresh and local. You know, here are some boring names, if you ask me. Gala in the Garden. How many of us have ever been to a Gala in the Garden or an Evening Under the Stars or a Gala for Hope? These are sort of like regular old branding efforts, 25th Century Gala. I sort of like Masquerade Ball because I think that ball is sort of a fun thing. But look at these. A lot of people are being very creative with their event branding strategies, and here's some that we found online. We were just doing some research, and I know a story. I think there's a town, maybe Nashville or somewhere, either Tennessee or Kentucky. There's a very elite event called the Swan Ball, S-W-A-N, Swan Ball, and it's white tie, and they're debutantes, and it's very la-di-da. And apparently the creative members of that community decided to have an alternative event that they call the Swine, S-W-I-N-E, the Swine Ball, as we call it in the South. And they had it in a barn, and everybody wore jeans, and they square danced, and apparently it was, again, the party of the decade. So having a little bit of fun with your event branding can set a tone that creates buzz across the community before you lift a finger. Catherine, have y'all ever used these sorts of branding opportunities?
Yes, we have. In fact, the auction event that we started 2 years ago, we branded as Art of the Auction, playing off the fact that we are an art museum and that it was also an art auction and that we felt we'd be really good at it. Therefore, we brought art to the event itself. So that was the branding, and it worked.
It really did work. I enjoyed that party a lot. I really did. Step number three is, and we have a few things to say about your committee. You need to fill your bus with put the right people on the bus, and that means the best committee. So what is a good committee for your party, your fundraising event? I like to have a committee that represents a very diverse group of people. I like to have all ages. I like to have different professions. You know, go out of your way and seek somebody in real estate, attorneys, doctors, bankers, creative types, internet types. I like to get people in different localities within my community. You know, there's the Northeast, Southwest, downtown crowd. Catherine, what do y'all look for when you put together a committee?
Well, really, Gail, what you're saying is exactly what we do. We believe in having a very diverse committee, age, social status, and kind of our social, heft, so to speak. Also, we really focus in on young people as well. They bring a certain level of energy, and they are the group, you know, of the future. We do look for different professions, as you're saying, and as we are the state art museum, the state of North Carolina's art museum, we want geographic diversity as well. So we do all
of
that.
One of the reasons, the reason that your committee is so important, Catherine, we could list these together. Your committee is also your brand. They are your social stamp for the party. And they will bring their friends. And so if I get an invitation and I see a bunch of my friends listed on the invitation, I think, well, gosh, I want to go to that. Or if I see an invitation and I see all these people I do not know, I've never heard of them, I'm not about to go unless somebody reaches out to me and says, come on and go with me. So you need to know, Catherine, what were you talking about before we started, spheres of influence?
Spheres of influence are critical. And so that's what we look for, people who have large spheres of influence that they can really be the ones who can really sell those tables and bring those people and put the bodies in the seat, which is what the event is about. You want to get people there. You have to have people there.
And we had a question from Karen or someone before. Maybe it was somebody entered a question at the very beginning about how important was it to have a VIP in the community to chair the event? Catherine, you want to answer that one real quickly?
Yeah, I think it's very important to have VIPs. They lend a certain cachet to your event, as Gail was saying. When you look at that, those people on the masthead of the invitation, the committee, and you recognize those names, even if you don't really know them, it still is a big draw of the event. I think it's important to have well-known people.
Terrific. And by the way, Tina just wrote in and said that the Swan Ball is in Nashville, so I was correct. Thank you very much, Tina, for correcting me on that. And I'd love to know, Tina, if you've ever been to the Swine Ball and if you could give me some feedback on that. That's the what party I want to go to. Now, we are talking about the devil in the details, and I want to take a firm stand with everyone listening about a detailed planning timeline, because this is what will save your life when you are organizing an event. You need to backwards schedule from the date of the event your mailing, drop date for mailings, you know, when is the auction stuff going to have to be ready, when do you have to have all of your sponsors' names closed out, how long is it going to take you to get your sponsors? You know, it's the timeline that can keep you up at night. Well, at the last 2 or 3 weeks, you will either sleeping at night or not. And here is a picture at the art museum, and just look at this crowd. They're all dressed up. Everybody in the state who is anybody is there. Catherine, what kind of event timeline do y'all use when you're planning?
Well, we really are out a year in advance of this event, and one of the key things at the beginning is what we just finished talking about was the committee recruitment. That's critical and takes a little bit of time. And then, as you're saying, starting with the event date and working back, because there's a certainly great deal element of promotion in this, so not only when the invitations are mailed and that type of thing, but when does it go on your website, when does it get included in your social media. You know, we have other vehicles of communication that we use, and we will add to those, say, 6 months out from the event, start putting in teasers for the event itself. And it's important, that timeline, and it also needs to be written out. It also needs to be where the responsibilities are assigned with deadlines. And it needs to be referred to frequently by your committee and by the staff who are staffing that group of volunteers.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea, too, of having everything in writing. And one of the reasons you need to have a detailed timeline is that, and from my point of view, sponsorships is where the money is, and sponsorships usually are where your profit is in your event. And let me tell you a quick story. Catherine and I were both involved with St. Mary's School here in Raleigh, an independent school that our daughters attended. And I was involved, God help me, I was involved in helping organize the very first auction that this school had. And I knew that if we could start this auction off with a format successfully, a financial format and a social format, then it could become a huge source of annual unrestricted revenue to the school. And so there I was, co-chair of this first event, and we didn't even know if anybody would walk in the door because we'd never had the event. We were all scared to death. The first thing I did was go out and sign five sponsors for $5,000 each. And I knew, I went to the trustees and I got that money. And I knew that even if our event was a bomb, that that money would wash over to the bottom line. And that has always been my rough rule of thumb in setting up an event to raise money, is that I try to have the ticket prices cover the cost of the event, and then the sponsorships and the auction are where the profit is. And so, Catherine, how do you go about getting your sponsors? Let's talk a little bit about your strategy.
We kind of have twofold. We do seek out sponsorships from businesses, local businesses with whom we have partnerships in the community, but often people overlook the importance of individuals. And so we have a strategy where we approach not only the committee themselves, but there are many, many members of the committee who can also be sponsors, but also don't forget your boards. Your board members are also well aware of what's going on usually and also should be sponsors. So we have a very strong effort to seek sponsorships from individuals. We found that to be really, in a lot of ways, for our event itself, more successful than our ability to go out and get corporate sponsorship. So that is important, I think, is really don't forget your individuals and start early. That should be, again, one of the things that towards the beginning of your timeline that you're working on.
Yes, Gail? Absolutely. And, yeah, and here are my favorite 10 pointers for securing sponsors at your event. You need to start early, at least 9 months ahead. And that's why I always tell organizations, don't have too many events. I think that if you just have one large event a year, you can raise much more money and you'll have more sanity than if you're trying to pack too many events in the year. And the reason is because of the timeline required to get the sponsorships done. And I think you need to set a goal. Our sponsorship goal is $50,000, $100,000, $500,000, whatever works. In New York City, sponsorships can be in the millions, as you know. As we can all dream, here in the hinterlands, we can dream of having the financial wherewithal to raise the kind of money they do in New York City. And I also believe in having a sponsorship committee and a chair to help get this work done. And I think a short prospect list is better than a longer one because the shorter prospect lists are more likely to get called on. And I like to go to last year's sponsors first because if we treated them well, they should be first in line for visibility. And, you know, I think when you're dealing with corporate sponsors, they do want visibility. And it is more selling than it is fundraising. Like Catherine, when she's going to her board members and individuals, she's doing fundraising. But the corporate sponsors for an event are looking for the visibility. And so, see, I like to go to a corporate sponsor and say, what kind of visibility would you like for this amount of money? We can give you these things. Does that suit you? We'll work with you. And you need to really work hard to get each sponsorship level special because sometimes I think the different categories can sort of run into each other and not be as interesting. And then here, Catherine's last two tips, look to individuals for sponsorships and get your board members to be table sponsors. And, Catherine, I'm afraid to ask you how much a table sponsorship is for one of your events.
Well, we actually have them tiered in that case, and they range between $10,000 and
$15,000. Okay. Well, you know, and step six is building the buzz. And, you know, we could talk for hours on how to use Facebook and social media to build a buzz. And I'm just going to leave it at that and say, because I think our co-sponsor, Lauren from Eventbrite, is going to talk a bit about helping to build the buzz as well, that building word of mouth, talking about this party is what's going to get people in the door. I like one of my favorite event strategies is how to get the VIPs there. Because if you notice, this is a picture of Daddy Warbucks, right? And, you know, you want the Daddy Warbucks that's in your community at your event. And here is the kind of party that attracts the VIPs in North Carolina to the Art Museum. Very la-di-da. And I have to tell you that my favorite strategy for getting VIPs to your event is, I'll describe it. One, create a list of the VIPs that you want to be sure they come. Two, get in touch with them personally and make sure they're coming. You know, you can say to them, like, I have somebody, I hope you're coming to our big gala. I have a great table for you to sit at, and I think you'd really enjoy these people. Or better yet, go get the people, get a party van. I was working in Texas last week with a group of people, and one of their board members has a limousine service. So they decided they were going to have a party van, party limo, and go around and pick up some of their VIPs. And, Catherine, y'all have done that before, haven't you?
We have done that, Gail. We have done that, and we've also one additional little special for the VIP we've done is sometimes have a very special VIP lounge that only the VIPs can go into, and sometimes we will have a particular time frame where, say, the director of the art museum is there, some other VIP board members are in there. So, you know, that's been a very nice touch that we've employed.
Yeah, and I think that you're moving on to step eight. I think that the atmosphere of the party is so very important. I think how you welcome people, you need to welcome them graciously. Board members should have assignments as being host and hostesses. I believe in having lower light and not too much light because it glaring overhead light does not create any sort of sense of atmosphere. You know, turn your lights. Turn the music up at the beginning and then down lower at the end when people are filling up. I think you don't want to have too large of a room. And, of course, there's another picture from our friends at the Museum of Art. And then I also like to have the young people there because older people love to have the young people around, and they're so cute and they're attractive and they're interesting. One of my secrets to a great party is to have all ages and really welcome the young people. Now, again, we could talk a lot about the program. Who is attending this webinar who has been at an event when the program got out of control? You had this laborious video. You had the laborious speaker. And so you need to keep it, you know, you're going to, I think the best way to control your video, your program, is to have an MC who introduces people and sort of brings them off the podium when their time is up. And I also think that every event program needs to have a call to action or not at all, right? So be sure that you have that call to action to send people out the door to do something. And then, of course, step 10, plan for next time, step 10. I think that you should try to recruit next year's chair while you are at this year's event because next year's chair could be is going to be happy seeing the great success, and she or he might be willing to say yes. And so here's a quick to-do list. The day the party's over, you know, call your guests for feedback and post pictures of them on your website. Say thank you to the donors and call guests who spent a lot of money and say thank you. It's very important to do your follow-ups because that sets the stage for happy relationships with all your attendees and sponsors after the event. And so let's talk a little tiny bit about the auction. We don't have a lot of time, but we do know that people raise a lot of money with auctions, and that's usually the centerpiece of an event. And here is your former chair of the board of the Art Museum in her orange dress, Joyce Fitzpatrick. Wasn't that the very first art of the auction, Catherine?
It was. It was the first auction, and she's using the BidPal, a bidding device, to work on silent auction items. I think Joyce walked away with several that night, Gail.
I think she did. And it was the very first introduction in Raleigh of this BidPal gizmo, and we were all trying to figure out how to use it. and nobody had any reading glasses, so it was a challenge. And you know, here are a few. We don't have time for a lot, but I want to give you our favorite auction tips. You know, you don't really want to raffle cars, but you need to keep men in mind because studies show that men are more likely to bid on live auction items than women. And so if that's so, you want things that men are going to want to bid on, and they love, of course, the hunting and fishing trips, you know. And you also want to get your Daddy Warbucks butts in the seats at your auction so because they're the ones with the discretionary income to buy those fabulous items. And I would suggest that your sound system can make or break your event. What do you think, Catherine?
Absolutely, it can. You've got to have a good sound system, and you need to test it in advance.
Yeah, I've seen auctions that completely failed because nobody could hear.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Timing is essential because I see people start leaving at 9 o'clock, and if you're still having your program and you haven't had your live auction and they're walking out the door, all that work is going down the drain. And another one of our favorite tips is experiences sell better than objects. So haven't you found that to be true, Catherine?
Absolutely. In fact, our live auction last year were all experiences. They had to be some kind of arts experiences, so a trip to New York with the director or a weekend at someone's beach house, that it encompassed more than just a house. It was visits to local art galleries. It was quite a few things. Absolutely, experiences.
Yeah, and I think people get stuck going around to local merchants and begging off these smaller items. And then everybody's so disappointed when the items don't go because people know how much they're worth. But an event or an experience, you know, how about a kid's birthday party in the locker room at the hockey after the hockey game? Or how about, tickets to the Duke Carolina basketball game, right, Catherine?
Since right,
Duke,
absolutely.
Carolina, ACC tournament tickets, you
yep,
know,
yep.
Things that they combined with a party van or dinner somewhere. Those kinds of things really enchant people and generate a lot of enthusiasm and bidding. And, you know, experiment with the new technology. We're not going to talk a lot about that, but I'm amazed at how the new technology, both online auctions tied to your live auction, and the BidPal and similar gizmos, all can really ratchet up your net in the event. And again, if you want to get my own tips in my own little event toolkit, you can download it at my website at startupfundraising.com/events. And so, here's some of my favorite stories, my blog articles about events, why you should ditch your next event. You might start with that one. As you know, this is a love song to parties because I love to throw parties. My Christmas party is my grand. In my obituary, when I die, they'll talk about my Christmas party. And I challenge you, my friends, to make your fundraising events fun, create the buzz, and everybody in town is going to want to come. They'll pack the halls, and they'll spend a whole lot more money because they're having so much fun. So thank you so much, and I'm going to turn our webinar over to our other friends. Okay, Margaret, are you going to pick up and do the Q&As? Are you going to interview our sponsor?
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Okay,
can you hear me now? I was muted.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so okay. I'm sorry about that. That only happens one other time, so my track record is pretty good. Okay, so you gave us some great advice. Thank you so much for that. So now we have all this great advice, and we could be preparing to have the event of the year, the decade, the century. But it's not going to fly if you don't promote it. So that is where Laura is going to come in. And Laura, thanks for joining us today. And I guess we can just get started. Let's start at the beginning. What is the best way to get started promoting your event?
Thanks, Margaret. And thank you, Gail, and thank you, Catherine, for some great tips and recommendations. I know I definitely learned something, and so just to dive here quickly into promotion a little bit, the best way to get started promoting an event, you want to begin to think about all the promotional channels that you'll use to promote your event. And if you can create a calendar that lists all of these activities in one place, it'll be really useful. We call this a promotional calendar or an editorial calendar. And one of the great things about this, it can be as simple as a Google Doc or a Google spreadsheet. You can share this with your committee. You can share this with other stakeholders so that they can see who owns particular activities. And so within your calendar, you want to include the marketing channel, so maybe it's email, for example, who the owner is, who's responsible for actually executing the activity, any additional stakeholders, as well as the date. And as you start to plan out all of these activities, you'll quickly be able to identify, are there any gaps, are there any holes? And over time, as you start measuring how these perform, you'll be able to adjust and really optimize as you're building up to your fundraiser or your gala that you're looking forward to. But if you plan all of this ahead of time, prior to even going on sale for your event, then you'll have a solid plan that you can execute against to really build up buzz for your event. So I do recommend using a Google Calendar or a spreadsheet and sharing it publicly with your team to hold everyone accountable. Excel works as well. And then you can go back and look for holes in your promotional calendar. Are you utilizing email? Are you utilizing social media? Are you utilizing your partners to their full capacity? And then as you're looking at this, carefully timed social media and email promotions, one of the things that we've noticed is that quite often organizers send out an email right when tickets go on sale, and then again the week before the event takes place. But there's a large gap in between. And we see the same thing with social media promotions. We see a spike in tweets and posts right when tickets first go on sale, and again when sales are coming to a close. But now that you know that weeks 2 through 5 are often pretty quiet, you can time your email, your social media, and leveraging partner efforts to take place during this time. Perhaps you could plan a contest or a promotion, think about offering a flash sale or a discount, and really time your heaviest pushes during the time you know ticket sales are the slowest.
And how, excuse me, how far out in advance would you suggest, and I'm sorry if you mentioned this, but I must have missed it, how far out in advance do you think you need to start planning? You know, you mentioned the whole idea of the editorial calendar. How early do you have to start with that?
That's a really great question. So on average, we see ticket sales for just the average fundraiser go on sale 4 to 6 weeks ahead of time. So I would definitely have your promotional calendar pulled together prior to that. If you are planning a larger annual event, I would start planning even 3 months prior. So it's ultimately going to depend on your organization and how, if this is an annual event or if this is something where you're expecting 5,000 attendees versus 500. But, you know, on average, like I said, we see 4 to 6 weeks, so I would keep that time frame in mind. But if you're looking for a much larger event and to really grow attendance, then you may want to back it out farther.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard this talked about in a variety of sessions and people that I've spoken to about events. Is it really the case that sometimes the follow-up to your event, the way you handle communicating with the people who came to your event, is actually the beginning of the promotion for your next event, or especially if it's an annual event? It's actually the beginning of the buzz for the following year's event. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, it certainly can be. If you already have next year's event planned, you know where it's going to occur, and you have your registration page up, there is no reason why in your thank you for your event that just ended, there's no reason why you can't promote that next year's event. And this can be very, very successful. People, they've just attended your event. They understand what the experience is like. They're kind of on a high from attending your event, getting to network with other people, and feeling really good about the experience. And so there's an opportunity for you to really engage in that feeling and encourage them, hey, you know, we're having this event a year from now. Why don't you go ahead and buy your tickets now? We're offering a special very early bird price. So absolutely, it's a great idea, especially for events that occur on an annual basis. And then people can start planning for this as a regular part of their schedule and something that they look forward to every year.
And you talked about how sometimes there'll be promotions that go out. Excuse me, I have to apologize. I'm sick right now, so if my voice sounds bad, that's what it is. But anyway, you talked about how promotions go out when tickets first go on sale, and then maybe there'll be another push sort of in the last week. Are there any techniques or ideas for keeping those sales consistent throughout the course of the selling period?
Yeah, absolutely. So on average for fundraisers, we naturally see two spikes in the ticketing life cycle, and I kind of referenced that a little bit prior. So if an event's going on sale, let's say those 6 weeks ahead of time, it's common to see a spike first when the tickets go on sale, and then again the week the event takes place. And if you've hosted an event before, and I'm sure many in the audience have since you're attending this webinar, but you know this is true because people love to procrastinate and they love to wait until the last minute to purchase their ticket. And what you want to do is really combat that ticketing life cycle and make it work for you so that you're not waiting until the last minute. You're not in a very stressful situation where you don't know exactly how many people are going to come. Understanding that there's going to be a natural lull in the time that tickets go on sale and the week of the event, there are a few steps that you can take to beat and to conquer that natural dip in the ticketing life cycle. So a couple of ideas. Initially, consider offering tiered ticketing prices in order to convenience attendees to commit to going earlier. So by offering ticketing at different price levels based off the time of purchase, people who might be on the fence about attending can be motivated if they know that they'll be saving money. So, for example, by pricing early bird tickets at, let's say, $50, general admission tickets at $60, and ticket purchase the day of the event at $75, people are more likely to purchase a ticket when the cost is actually lower. And by selling more tickets in advance, you won't be in such a panic the week of the event or worry that you won't sell enough tickets. One of the other effective strategies that I've seen for getting people to buy early bird is often used. That can be effective, but what we've seen more recently is what we call a flash sale, and it's very similar to early bird, but oftentimes you might attach a physical gift along with that early purchase. So the attendees will receive a discounted price. Maybe it's offered to the first 100 registrations that you receive. In addition to that, if you're having, an author speak at your event, maybe it's a signed copy of their latest book, or maybe it's a free bottle of wine if it's a wine tasting fundraiser. You know, you can come up with a special gift that can even be donated by other sponsors so that they receive additional promotion and exposure. So this doesn't necessarily need to be an additional cost to you and your organization, but it is a great way to get people to buy early, to get excited, and to share it with their friends and colleagues so that they will purchase early.
Did you think that there is, or can you pinpoint maybe one or two well, we're talking about the devil in the details. So can you pinpoint a couple of mistakes that you feel that organizations tend to make when it comes to promoting their events?
Yeah, this is pretty straightforward, but we see the most common mistake we see is that an initial email might be sent when the tickets go on sale, and then one final email kind of the week before the event. And really, you want to be calendaring out and planning all of your activities in a very methodical manner. A second mistake that we see is that event organizers tend to not log in to be viewing their event reports to see how their ticket sales are doing. They tend to not log in often enough. Or really, we see event organizers logging in maybe the week prior. And at that point, there's not as much that you can do to influence how many people are going to purchase tickets at that point, and it's going to be very stressful for you. So logging in to review your data and analytics on a regular basis, at least every week, if not every other day, so that you can accurately be seeing how many ticket sales are coming in, what promotional channels are working, and we'll talk about how to track that in just a minute here. But really, paying attention to your data and analytics, and understanding how many ticket sales are coming in, so that you are keeping a strong pulse. When we see organizers logging in to review these types of reports, those are the fundraisers that meet their goals. There is a very, very strong correlation to this, and it just makes sense. If you're keeping a natural pulse on the activity that's going on, then you'll know, oh, we need to plan an additional email, or we need to pull in an additional partner, or maybe one partner isn't pulling their weight, and you need to encourage them to be promoting out to their audience and give them some best tips and recommendations for doing so.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you would talk about tracking your promotional channels. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the a final piece that I can leave you with here is one thing that we see, if you've initially created this promotional calendar, you can also create tracking links for each and every one of your activities so that you know and understand what's actually driving registrations and driving sales for your fundraiser. So tracking links are by far and large the most efficient and the easiest way to understand what marketing efforts are working for you and which ones are not. You can set up tracking links for each channel that you're using to promote your event in a matter of seconds. Tracking links can either be set up through a registration platform that you're using like Eventbrite, or you can even use your web analytics tool like a Google Analytics. And once you've created these links, be sure to provide your partners or your host committee members with their appropriate link so that they can use that link when getting the word out about your event. And then you, as the organizer, can review your event reporting and see which link is generating the most amount of clicks and if any of the clicks have actually converted into sales. This will be very, very effective for you for the event you're organizing, but also for future events because you'll be able to analyze which channels are resulting in sales and then be able to double down on that moving forward or shift budget around so that you can really optimize and maximize the ones that are working versus the ones that aren't. And we've received a lot of questions about doing this because sometimes it seems like creating a promotional calendar and creating tracking links can take a lot of time. But really, creating tracking links doesn't need to take you more than 15 or 20 minutes, and it can really save you and your organization a lot of money and also a lot of time so that you're really efficiently maximizing the channels that are going to drive the most amount of ticket sales versus the ones that aren't. And you can even imagine if you're monitoring this in the weeks building up to your fundraiser, and if you have a host committee, if you have different partners that are responsible for bringing in a certain number of registrations, you can create a little sense of competition if you're using unique tracking links for each one of them. And you can praise the partners that are bringing in registrations and that are bringing in high-value donors. And you'll be amazed that, you know, people can become very naturally competitive. And when they hear the praise of one partner versus their own organization, they might be more likely to participate themselves and start promoting your event more than they were prior.
Let's go back to the promotional calendar that you've mentioned a few times. How fluid would you suggest that be? I mean, I can see, you know, some management type saying, okay, we have this calendar and we are going to stick to it and, you know, we can't stray from that. But then there are others who might say, okay, well, that didn't quite work. Maybe we can just switch this and switch that. How much fluidity do you suggest be involved in that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I definitely start with a plan, have a plan, and pull together what you believe are the best practices. So, you know, your first email send, your email invitation, your second reminder, and your third last chance email, for example, and calendar out all of the promotional activities that you want to do for Facebook or for Twitter, for example. For Facebook, we recommend to promote your event 2 to 3 times per week and really no more than that. But with Twitter, you can be having a more active conversation every day, but you want to think about creative ways to organically bring up your event. So, for example, versus, hey, come to our event, you can feature a special speaker, or you can feature one of your sponsors, or share video from one of your last events to give attendees an understanding of what it might be like. So really have a solid plan. Come up with these ideas, hold brainstorms so that you have created a solid promotional plan prior to your tickets going on sale. But then as you start executing that plan, don't be afraid to change it. Don't be afraid to pivot. Absolutely, you'll see, and especially if this is kind of a first-time or second-time event, you'll see that certain channels may not work as well as you thought that they would. And so you may need to change your strategy. You may need to optimize your posts. And so paying close attention to that, which is why, again, logging into to take a look at your reporting and how many ticket sales are coming from each of the activities that you're doing. This will help you monitor and optimize as you go. And you can update, you know, this is not need to be a static document by any means. You should be updating and making changes and receiving feedback as you go so that you can have the most effective event as possible. And then you'll have an updated, more effective blueprint for your next event coming up.
So it's definitely an evolving process.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I am going to take a look at some of the questions that we have coming in from the audience. We have quite a few, actually. So I will put them out there, and you know, whoever feels most comfortable answering, go ahead. The first one kind of goes back to something that Gail and Catherine talked about really early on, and it's about the name. And the question is, we did our first gala a year ago, and we plan on doing another one in 2015. Would you use the same name as the organization is planning on doing, or going with something new, or should you really only change the name after you've used it for 5 years or so?
Well, this is Gail, and I think if the first event was successful and everybody enjoyed it and had a good time, then you can use the same branding again, and I think it will build on the success before. So I would keep using the same title and brand until you sense a lack of enthusiasm, or maybe right before, because you know you want to change the brand before it's too late, right?
This is Catherine, and I totally agree with Gail. There's a really fabulous party in Raleigh, North Carolina, put on by the SPCA that's called the Fur Ball, and it's been that name is so synonymous with huge success that they have kept that. It's really, really created a brand for that organization.
However, I've been with other organizations. I remember one organization I was working with in Asheville, and they were having a capital campaign, and their gala was going downhill. And I just drew the line. I said, you cannot have a gala going downhill in the middle of a capital campaign. We've got to ratchet this thing up or not do it at all. So people usually know when your event is starting to get a little tired. Great question. Thank you for that.
And now we want to talk a little bit about committee members for the
event.
Yeah,
I saw those, yeah.
Is there a place where our attendees can find a job description for committee members, or certain things that you would recommend absolutely be spelled out for them so that they know what to expect? I mean, I'd imagine it's sort of like dealing with your organization's board. You want to be clear about what is expected, and what are your recommendations in that regard?
Gosh, Margaret, I can't think of anything more important than to have really, really, really clear expectations for the committee, because there's nothing that hurts the volunteers' feelings more for them to think that they have authority to make a decision and then the decision is yanked away from them, like the volunteer has the authority to find the venue, set the budget, or not. I mean, it's up to you to decide. You know, one time I was involved with an event, and the volunteers decided they had to have this gushy la-di-da invitation with heavy paper and silver type that you could not see and fancy cursive scrolling, and it cost a fortune. And so somebody was not managing that committee and did not give that committee strong enough guidelines. I do think, personally, I want to be really careful what I ask my committee to do and what authority I give them. Because your committee can go crazy and spend, you know, without a strong budget. If you leave too much up to your committee, such as logistics, if it's run by volunteers are not always on timeline. They are not always taking their job seriously. And I've been involved in way too many situations where the staff had to jump in at the last minute, and it was extremely stressful. So I like to have committees charged with filling a table, and maybe getting sponsorships, you know, very, very clear jobs. They come to the committee meetings, and they fill their table, and they attend, and they make a personal sponsorship. What do you think, Catherine?
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Gail. And just to build on that just a little bit, written committee job descriptions are critically important. And if you want to give, at least your chair or co-chairs a little bit of say in some of that, you can sit down with them at the very beginning, early on in that timeline, and give them a draft and little tweaking go on, but make it really clear to them what those parameters are, who's deciding what, because when they're standing up in front of the committee, they need to be really helping to lead that charge as well. So become a real partner, a co-partner with your committee chairs in that respect, I think creates a real successful event.
And I would also say that I believe in committees in name only sometimes, because I wanted the staff to manage the whole event, and we asked committee people if they would serve and come and do a sponsorship so that we could use their name. And I also have to share with you a strategy. I used to work for UNC Chapel Hill. I ran the Kenan Flagler Business School fundraising program, and we had an event in Atlanta. And you know what I did? I called all of the donors in Atlanta who had ever who had given $1,000 last year, who were members of the Dean's Club, and I just called them up. I said, "Can we list your name on the invitation just to honor you?" And oh, you would have thought they had died and gone to heaven. They were absolutely thrilled to get that attention. And we had a private pre-party for the sponsors a half an hour before the regular event, so they all got to rub shoulders with each other, and then all the big shots were there at the beginning for the other people to come in and see. Sometimes you have a hard time getting the big shots to actually show up.
Laura, I'm going to switch over to you. This is probably a pretty tricky question, although it seems pretty simple, but are there any recommendations for the best day and time to send email blasts when it comes to your events and promoting them?
Yeah. That's a great question, really great question. So I'll give you some best practices on average. So on average, the best day and time to send your emails will be Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, from 9 to 11 a.m. And we do see on Monday, for example, that's not the best day because people are, for working professionals, they're getting into the office. They may have a whole stream and a whole slew of emails to get through for their busy work day to start off the work week. So I wouldn't focus on Monday. And then similarly with Friday, people are thinking about the weekend and what they're going to do with their family, with their children, with friends. And, again, Friday's probably not the best day. So on average, we see Tuesday through Thursday in the morning as the best times. But my big caveat here is that it's really going to depend on your audience. So, for example, if you are reaching stay-at-home moms, for example, reaching them in the afternoon when there's a little bit of quiet time, That might be a much better time than in the morning when they're busy, they're taking their kids to school or whatever it is. So ultimately, it's going to be unique to your audience, unique to your organization, and you really want to test it to optimize and find the best times. But you can start with some of those best practices and see if it works for you.
Great. And I guess this would be for anyone to answer, really. How do you deal with late registrations that are beyond your RSVP date? Is there a absolutely no, we cannot handle this, or is there a way for handling that?
Catherine, I know you have run into this at the Art Museum.
Yeah.
So what do y'all do, hold some extra tickets back for the biggies at the last minute?
We don't necessarily hold any back. We just try to expand our spaces as best we can. One of those things with our art of auction, even though we sell tables and so forth, it's not a seated event. So it allows us to expand. When I say seated, it's not a place carded sit-down dinner. It's a more of a walk-around cocktails, and that gives us a great deal more flexibility in adding people at the last minute, because when you get that VIP person, that big donor or that board member or somebody who, for whatever reason, is at the 12th hour wanting to sign up, do not want to tell that person no if you can help it. So we try to make the event flexible in order to be able to do that. We rarely say no.
Is there an industry standard for ROI for fundraising events, money raised versus money spent?
Well, you know, Margaret, when all is said and done, the industry standard is it costs 50 cents on the dollar to raise a dollar. That 50% of your, if you include staff time, usually you're only making 50 cents on the dollar. And so events are the least profitable fundraising strategy there is. And smart fundraisers make sure that you don't have too many events and that you have a major gift program, a mailing, annual giving program, and events to complement, because events do help a lot with the PR and do help you build relationships with some of your major donors if they're handled correctly or not. So just be aware. I started to put that slide up. I have a slide about, and if you look, go to my blog post on fundraising events at my blog, you'll see that that ROI chart, and I think it's in the blog post called Why You Should Ditch Your Next Event. With my thinking is, ditch your next event and just focus on one or two a year. You'll raise a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret, there is a question I would love to answer.
Sure.
If I can find it. Somebody wrote in and asked about non-fundraising events that are just donor cultivation events. And thank you so much for asking that, because that is a basic ingredient of every major gift program, is that you do have donor thank you events. And when I was doing major gift fundraisers as a staff fundraiser, and I'm sure Catherine does this too, that small, elegant dinners and socials and receptions to honor individual donors' gifts with an exclusive VIP list are bread and butter of major gift fundraising program, and I feel like they are wonderful cultivation events for the next donors, because if you have this free feel good event, to use Terry Axelrod's words, you know that you honor a donor's gift, but you invite all the other people who haven't given yet, and your major donors standing up there telling the world why they believe in this organization, why this is so important, and everybody's thanking them. And your prospects who have not yet given are getting cultivated all over the place. Don't you think, Catherine?
I agree. I love that kind of small, exclusive event that says thank you, and the small, exclusive event to cultivate donors. I've got I'll be very brief. But last fall, we had a great one where we had a couple who actually underwrote the event. We had 30 people, about 15 couples, all invited personally by the other couple. They stood up. They said all the right things, all the wonderful things. Other people started taking the microphone, quote, unquote, to also weigh in on how wonderful it is to support the art museum. Not only did we raise some new gifts from that, we made many new friends and furthered the relationship we had with the couple who hosted it. It was just it was beautiful. And so those little events, don't overlook them. Don't overlook the investment in those small events.
Mm-hmm. They'll pay back.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. We need to talk a little bit about social media, because and I know we've mentioned it a little bit, but it's a big deal. And this may kind of get into a little bit of peer-to-peer type fundraising, but Laura, for example, if you have an event that you're planning and you're trying to promote, how do you go about getting, through social media, getting the people who are coming to your event or sponsoring your event, how do you make it easy for them to then promote the event for you?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I would look for in terms of best practices, you want to make sure the event page that you're using for people to register is already integrated with social media. So, for example, on the event page, there should be the like button, the tweak button. That's kind of the bare minimum, the LinkedIn share button and whatnot. But then beyond that, you really want to make sure that your event page is also prompting, once someone has purchased, or registration, prompting that attendee to share the event with their friends, and with their colleagues and with their network. This is by far and large what we see to be a very, very effective strategy. And the reason why is, once someone has purchased that ticket, they're excited, they're committed to go, and they're excited to share it with their network. And you can imagine, when you see a post on Facebook, for example, or a post on Twitter, it's a much stronger call to action if you see, hey, I'm going to this great fundraiser, it's for a great cause, who's in, who's with me? That's a much stronger call to action versus, I'm thinking about going to this event, who else is interested? And because of that, we see the vast majority, over 60% of fundraising dollars come in from individuals who have shared the event once they've already purchased their ticket. And so really pay attention to that. And then you as the organizer, there's some things that you can do to make this go even further. You can send out an email to groups of attendees once they've already purchased their registration and encourage them to share it on their platform of choice. Some individuals will be more familiar and comfortable with Facebook. Others will be very active on Twitter. And if you're communicating with them and communicating with them regularly on social media, you can give them great fodder. Hey, we just signed on this great speaker. Or, hey, this new sponsor's coming in, and they're going to be donating, different types of wine for people to try or whatever it is. But you can do a lot through your own social media channels to create buzz and give attendees really great fodder to share and communicate with their network. So, definitely you as the organization should be active on your social media channels, but a great way to help your promotion go farther is to be able to utilize the networks of your attendees, because you won't have that reach, and it can help your event go much farther and help you reach new people and new donors and really expand your network and your community.
Okay, great. I think we could probably go for another hour, but we are out of time. If we did not get to your answers, keep an eye out on Today in Fundraising, because we are going to try to get some more questions answered. That's our daily e-newsletter. And, yes, we are just about out of time. On behalf of Fundraising Success and Eventbrite, I want to thank everyone for attending, and I would like to thank our speakers. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And if you would take just a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that should be on your screen right now, we'd be grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. Again, thank you so much for joining us. We loved having you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.